Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update webinar on the case City and County of San Francisco versus the Environmental Protection Agency. Speaking on the panel today, we have Professor Robin Craig and Andre Monette. Professor Jonathan Adler is joining us as our moderator today and is a professor of law and the founding director of the Coleman P. Burke Center for Environmental Law at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor Adler, thank you for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Great. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's great to be here with our two panelists to talk about this important case, the first of what may turn out to be several environmental law cases that the court is going to hear this term. The court has two on the docket so far and some cert petitions that could add more environmental law cases. So on October 16th, the Supreme Court will hear oral argument in the case we're going to talk about today, City and County of San Francisco versus the Environmental Protection Agency. It's an important Clean Water Act case challenging the EPA's imposition of what some call narrative or generic standards in Clean Water Act permits. And to discuss this case and unpack the arguments, the issues, and the implications of this case, I'm really pleased to be joined by two Clean Water Act experts that know far more about this than I do, Andre Monette and Professor Robin Kundis Craig. Andre Monette is the managing partner of the Washington, D.C. office of Best, Best & Krieger LLP, where he represents water districts, cities, counties, and agricultural interests and other entities on matters involving the Federal Clean Water Act and its state law analogs. Of note, he filed an amicus brief on behalf of several state and local government entities in this case. And Professor Robin Kundis Craig is the Robert A. Schroeder Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Kansas School of Law. She has previously taught at least seven other institutions, including the University of Southern California, University of Utah, Florida State University, and Lewis and Clark. She's one of the most widely cited environmental law professors in the country. Among her multiple books is The Clean Water Act and the Constitution, published by the Environmental Law Institute. And as Edith noted, more complete bios are available on the website. But we should get into discussing this case. And I think it's worth starting off with just a little bit of background or context. So, Andre, this case concerns the requirements that are imposed on companies, cities, other entities that emit into waters of the United States and need to obtain Clean Water Act permits for those discharges. Can you just give us a real brief overview of the Act permitting requirements just to set the stage for the legal issues in this case?
Absolutely. But yeah, first, let me just say thank you for having me. It's really an honor to be here. And thank you for the kind words. I don't believe that I know more than you do, because I just don't. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about the Clean Water Act. That's a great way to start. As most of you could probably know, the Clean Water Act is based around a permitting system. There's different facets to it. One facet is states are required to adopt what are called water quality standards for all of the surface water bodies within their jurisdiction. The minimum threshold that they can use for setting that is fishable and swimmable. States adopt that. They send it to EPA. EPA approves it. EPA then can issue permits under the Clean Water Act that will allow dischargers to discharge wastewater or other, you know, effluent into those surface waters. EPA will often delegate that authority to states, who will then, you know, issue those NPDES permits. It's called the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permits, in lieu of EPA within those states. Importantly, these permits do a few things. One, the scheme makes it illegal to discharge pollutants into the surface waters without a permit. Two, there's two different types of controls that are supposed to be included in these permits. One are called technology-based effluent limits, or TBELs, things that are based on the process of how treatment is done at the particular, you know, plant or point of discharge. And two, what are called water quality-based effluent limits. And those are effluent limits that are designed to make sure that whatever comes out of that pipe that goes into the surface water is sufficient to make sure that those surface waters attain the water quality standards that the states have adopted. Some would argue there's a third category. I think that's kind of what's coming up here is, are there such other limitations available that are neither technology-based or effluent-based limitations? And if so, what does that mean? And so that's kind of one of the issues before the court in this case. But that's sort of the lay of the land. Hopefully, you know, if I left anything out, please, you know, jump in and correct me.
No, that sounds good. So Robin, we generally think of the MBDES permits as imposing specific limits on the amount of a given pollutant. So, you know, you're allowed, you know, to emit a certain amount over a given time period from a particular source. This case involves what some people want to refer to as narrative standards, others refer to as generic standards. Can you kind of unpack kind of what this type of standard is that's at the center of this case?
Okay, sure, Jonathan, and thanks as well to inviting me to be here. Generic or narrative standards impose a narrative requirement, for lack of a better term. So these can be specific requirements for, say, a discharger to engage in a specific best management practice in handling its waste, or engage in a particular kind of monitoring if the EPA wants to impose that kind of requirement. So those kinds of positive requirements. What's at issue here are the generic or narrative prohibitions. And they basically say the discharger is not allowed to violate water quality standards. So in contrast to, say, you can discharge this concentration of nutrients or this concentration of mercury or whatever it is you're discharging, it basically says don't muck with the water quality standards. Don't allow a violation of that. These have been around for a while, actually. They're often in permits when there are water quality-based effluent limitations, and that's often the result of the fact that states set narrative water quality standards and narrative water quality criteria, which means there's kind of a focus in the background about the duties of a permit writer. So if you've got a narrative water quality standard and the state's not giving you any numeric guidance to go with to begin with, it's often comes down to the permit writer if you're going to require a numeric concentration to translate that. But like I said, these have been around for a while. In part, they started because it took a while to figure out what the numeric limitation should be. So a classic one was toxics. A lot of states had water quality standards that said basically no toxic pollutants and toxics amounts. And that's what got written into permits. Now we've gotten better at that. The numerics have been developing over time. And for example, California, for its specific ocean water quality standards, has a daily limit on mercury of 0.16 micrograms of mercury per liter, which is 160 parts per trillion. So, you know, we've gotten more of these numeric things as we've gone along. They've got numerics for E. coli. You need an average of 200 E. coli per milliliter of ocean water. So, you know, we've gotten better at that. But there are still a lot of narrative criteria out there. And as I'll probably discuss later, that's particularly relevant with the ocean. But there's two narrative criteria that are issue in this case that are part of the City and County of San Francisco's NPDES permit for its oceanside combined sewer system, which has got seven outflows into the Pacific Ocean. And so the two that made it into its permit are Section 5 of the permit, which says the discharge shall not cause or contribute to a violation of any applicable water quality standard. And there's the city and county have an exception for 8 combined sewer overflow events a year. So that's wrapped into it as well. The second narrative standard that's in this permit is in attachment G to the permit, which says neither the treatment nor the discharge of pollutants shall create pollution, contamination, or nuisance as defined in California Water Code Section 13050. If you look that up, contamination occurs when a discharge causes a hazard to public health through either poisoning or spread of the disease. Pollution is an alteration in the water quality that affects the beneficial uses of that water. And nuisance is a public nuisance. There's a 3-part test California uses, but a basic public nuisance. So those are the ones that are at issue here. And we can talk about what that all means to the legal arguments going forward.
Well, great. Thank you for that. So, Andre, let's turn to the legal arguments here. So San Francisco, we usually think of San Francisco as a jurisdiction that's concerned about environmental protection. There is kind of the interesting background here of this being San Francisco versus the EPA. It sued to challenge these specific narrative limitations. What is San Francisco's legal argument? So why is it that San Francisco thinks that these sorts of limits are not permissible under the Clean Water Act?
Well, I think, there's a couple of reasons. And some of it goes back to the history of the act and the structure of the act. I mean, if you wanted to use very simply put, they don't think that the EPA has the authority to impose what amount to water quality based effluent limits without going through the whole process that EPA has set up to establish those kinds of limits. It comes down to the interpretation of 33 USC 1311 B1C and whether or not a limit in that section that is tied directly to compliance with water quality standards is a water quality based effluent limit and needs to go through the development process. That's the technical argument. That's the textual ask that I think San Francisco is presenting to the court. But you got to look back at the structure of the act and where it's come from and where it is now to kind of have a little more context for that. I mean, famously, we all have cited Professor Adler as a teacher at one point. We all learned about the history of the Clean Water Act and how it originally was tied to the Rivers and Harbors Act and really focused on keeping channels open for navigation. And over time, that wasn't good enough. And so there were various iterations that throughout the 60s were really aimed at maintaining the quality of water in the waterways. And so it was a backing out from that kind of approach to regulation. It still wasn't working in the 60s. And so in 1972, Congress rewrote the act and instead decided to focus on what's coming out of the end of each pipe. And everyone's going to be responsible for what comes out of their pipe. And together, that's going to add up to, if EPA is doing its job right, and the states are too, that's going to add up to attainment of water quality standards. So it was a sea change in 1972 when that act changed. I've had the privilege of working with folks that were on staff in the Senate at that time, and they will tell you're blue in the face, Democrats, Republicans. Yeah, we wanted to change this. We wanted to add technology and responsibility to the dischargers so that they could be held accountable for what's going into the surface waters. So that's the change. We're going to measure compliance at the end of pipe. We're going to say, this is what you can put in and out of your pipe or out of your pipe, period. And if you don't do that, you're in violation. What these narrative or generic prohibitions, it's kind of a misnomer. I like how Professor Kunis Craig mentioned it, was like, this is an outright prohibition. And it's different from other kinds of narrative limitations that show up in permits. I mean, the classic ones that, again, were mentioned were best management practices, like, hey, store your toxic waste in barrels with very tight lids on them. Like, that's a narrative limitation that is common, right? This is instead turning the Clean Water Act's 1972 amendments on their head by saying anything you put out there, if it causes or contributes to an exceedance of the water quality standard, you're now responsible for it. So it's like you're violating the Clean Water Act if one molecule of pollutant from your pipe, even if it doesn't, you know, one molecule contributes to an exceedance of the water quality standard in that receiving water. How do you measure that? How do you do that? It's really an impossible situation for these dischargers. So I think that's a long-winded way of saying San Francisco is upset because this particular type of narrative prohibition is turning the act on its head, and it looks like a violation of 1311B1C.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I guess, and this may be important context too, and for those that are Supreme Court watchers, this was just an interesting development, right? After San Francisco had filed its cert petition in this case and the Justice Department had responded, EPA initiated an enforcement action against San Francisco, within I forget how many days it was, but relatively quickly after the briefing in the cert stage of this case had completed. And then San Francisco filed a supplemental notification to the court about this. And some of us think that might be part of why this case was granted or cert was granted, making it clear that San Francisco at least potentially did have to worry about enforcement. Robin, Andre kind of laid out why San Francisco thinks this is a problem, right? The idea that a numerical standard, you know what to do, how to comply with it. A narrative standard that tells you the specific thing to do, use this treatment process, you know, store things in a particular way, you know how to comply with it. EPA maintains that this kind of standard, the sort of standard that is being imposed on San Francisco, is not particularly unusual, sort of thing that EPA has done for some time. Can you kind of outline for us why EPA believes this is permissible and whether you think those arguments are impacted by things like Loper Bright, which arguably constrain the extent to which agencies can interpret statutes?
Okay, so a lot there. So I'll just start with the Loper Bright comment. The Ninth Circuit did give Chevron deference to the EPA. Clearly can't do that anymore after Loper Bright. I will say the EPA structured its brief to not rely on Chevron at all. So the EPA has kind of acknowledged that it's not going to get any deference at all. One thing I will say that's interesting about this case and a lot of cases involving water quality standards under the Clean Water Act, the EPA and several of the amici emphasized to the court that water quality standards are a state prerogative. And one of the aspects of the history of the Clean Water Act in the Supreme Court that's been interesting is that even when the court divides over issues of the EPA's authority under the statute, they tend to unify when it comes to state prerogatives under the Clean Water Act. And that's been particularly true with water quality standards and states' ability to use Section 401 of the Act to enforce their water quality standards. So this is a weird permit because it's got both EPA and the state of California involved. But like I said, I think it's interesting in the briefing that a lot of the briefers are taking great care to remind the court that water quality standards are a state thing. But back to the main question, EPA has framed this up as, does the Clean Water Act allow it to impose conditions, limitations, and permits that are not numeric effluent limitations? And as Andre mentioned, it gets into a really technical statutory interpretation argument, centering on Section 1311B1C, which refers to both effluent limitations and other limitations. And so the EPA has got a fairly technical statutory interpretation argument, reminds the court that Congress explicitly adopted the 1994 combined sewer overflow policy, which has some reference to narrative standards in it. It focuses on the fact that there are effluent limitations and these other limitations in Section 1311B1C. because these other limitations, these any more stringent limitation does not use the word effluent, the EPA argues that a plain meaning says they can add other stuff. It even gets into legislative history and the drafting of the statute that there was that any more stringent limitation, one version would have had effluent limitation at the end of that, and it was consciously removed. It also stresses that this has been its consistent interpretation of the Clean Water Act from the get-go, that it's used these. And then it cites three Supreme Court opinions back to the Supreme Court, National Association of Manufacturers versus Department of Defense from 2018, PUD number one of Jefferson County, which is one of those state water quality standards cases from 1994, and Arkansas versus Oklahoma, which was interstate water pollution and the enforceability of water quality standards across borders. None of them are exactly on point, but each of them has language that seems to indicate that EPA's interpretation was accepted by the Supreme Court. Now, one thing I will note that is going to be interesting to see where this case goes is the EPA has basically made this a facial challenge of whether these standards are allowed or not under the Clean Water Act. As the cert question was framed, the court could actually go a little bit more broadly than that. The San Francisco's strongest arguments are actually as applied, that even if certain kinds of narrative standards or other kinds of standards are allowed, these particular ones are a little broad or ambiguous or not giving them their due process notice of what they have to do to comply. EPA has said that those arguments have been waived. And so it'll be interesting to see what the court thinks about that waiver argument and how willing it is to reach beyond just pure, are some generic or narrative standards allowed at all, to what is the status of these in particular that got included in this permit. So that'll be fun to watch.
Just a quick follow up on that. I mean, do you think that one thing we should at least listen for in oral argument is whether between that question and the fact that the Ninth Circuit relied upon Chevron, you know, is this a good candidate for just sending it back down for a do-over?
It might. On the other hand, the Supreme Court has announced quite loudly that it's fully capable of doing statutory interpretation on its own. So, if it gets into a due process argument, that's pure con law. So it's not the kind of fact-based analysis that would require a remand for a do-over. Huh. So the mood they've been in lately, I don't think they will, but we'll see.
It's interesting. And I think it's also worth noting the point you make or highlighting about there is a question of how narrowly or broadly the court wants to look at this question. For folks that are following the other administrative law cases before the court this term, the NEPA case that the court will hear later this fall, there's similarly a question about how broadly or narrowly to look at that, the question there. In that case, the federal government and the petitioners are on the same side, but the federal government had filed against certiorari and is asking the court to resolve the case really on the narrowest grounds in its favor in that case, because of it wants more leeway in other contexts. Returning to this case, Andre, you filed a brief in this case on behalf of Local Government Legal Center, National Association of Counties, National League of Cities, International Municipal Lawyers Association, and the League of California Cities. So I take from that local governments are very concerned about this case, very interested in this case. It's not just about the specifics of San Francisco's permit. Can you kind of unpack for us a bit why it is that, you know, local government organizations are so focused on the issues in this case?
Yeah, and that's a great question. Thanks for that. A lot of it comes back to something that's come up, you know, a couple times in our conversation already. It's sort of what on the discharger end of things, we believe to be the arbitrary nature of these prohibitions, right? If you're prohibited from causing or contributing to an exceedance of a water quality standard, it's really hard to know how to do that. If the water body that you're discharging into is not attaining a standard for, say, bacteria, is discharging a single bacteria too much, even though you may be well below whatever the standard is for recreational swimming coming out of your pipe, there's still five bacteria in it and you're over the standard. You've contributed to being over the standard, right? So, or conversely, if you're discharging way above what would be swimmable and fishable for recreational purposes, et cetera, for bacteria, but the water quality is, you know, almost there or getting there in the future, you know, where's your line? It's really difficult to find. There's a variety of scenarios where you could be in violation and really have no notice of it. So that's put wastewater treatment plants and cities that operate stormwater systems in a very rough position where they're pretty much out of compliance with their Clean Water Act permits upon any time. And it leaves a gigantic hole open for lawsuits by citizens groups, environmental groups, or, you know, states or EPA. A lot of the action on this has come out of California because California explicitly adopted this kind of language back in like 2010, 2011 as a state policy. And that's what's kind of interesting about this case that Professor Goodness Craig mentioned is that, this is a dual permit because San Francisco has an outfall that goes out past the state jurisdiction. And so EPA issues the permit for that part, but the state of California issues it for the rest of it. Long story short of it, a lot of liability lies in this language and these prohibitions and a very difficult pathway to compliance for municipalities and POTWs. And this has resulted in some of the permits in California being issued in ways that force, and maybe this is good or bad, but they force these municipalities to spend billions and billions of dollars on infrastructure that the state has agreed, okay, you do that and we'll deem you in compliance, but it's still no guarantee that you're going to meet the standard because there's still bacteria in the Los Angeles River when you're done, right? So it's a cudgel that has been used against public agencies in a way that really hasn't, it makes them very concerned. And so again, California's faced this, but obviously this case has a tandem case coming out of the Second Circuit. So it's happened elsewhere. It's just that, we've seen it the most probably in California the last couple of years. So, that's the area of focus for the cities.
Two follow-ups there. I mean, to what extent are local government concerns driven by situations like this where the state is embracing the use of these standards? Is the concern broader than that scenario in the sense that where states haven't, or is there still concern about the EPA's approach, if perhaps in a state that doesn't have delegated authority or where outfalls are beyond state jurisdiction, or is it kind of limited to states that have embraced this approach?
Well, I mean, EPA uses this language in a variety of different settings. They like to use it. And so it's standard language in many of their Clean Water Act permits. You can cite them from Ohio, all over the place. So that liability goes with almost any Clean Water Act permit. In fact, that was originally one of EPA's defenses. It's sort of the Mike Tyson defense. We do this all the time. I'm a little old. But, they've been doing this for a long time and no one's really called them on it. And it finally is coming to the fore. But I when we work with cities and municipalities that are having to deal with the outcome, that's what they're focused on. Like, we don't want to be stuck with this liability. The Clean Water Act is supposed to give you a shield. If you comply with your permit, you're not going to be sued by an environmental group or the state or whatever. And this takes that away. You're almost always in violation some way or another of these permit conditions because it's like causing or contribute is such a nebulous standard. And we raise this, but there is an industry of folks that go around and file lawsuits and here's $50,000 and I'll go away. Here's $70,000 and I'll go away because you violated these four things in your permit. So, there's good things about the state attorney, citizen attorney general provisions in the Clean Water Act. They've been used in the past to force change, but there's also a lot of abuse that happens. And this gives a better pathway for that. So again, that's the core to my experience of that concern.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was actually going to follow up with a question on that. But how much of this is the concern of local governments driven by the citizen suit provisions, as opposed to, you know, concerns about EPA enforcement or even state level enforcement? And from what you're saying, it sounds like a lot of the concern is that independent organizations can file suit. The only way to make those suits go away is to settle, or for the relevant agency to diligently enforce.
Well, the worst case scenario. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The worst case scenario already came up. It was the Los Angeles County v. Natural Resources Defense Council case that went to the Supreme Court and then back to the Ninth Circuit in like 2014 or so. In that case, Natural Resources Defense Council sued County of Los Angeles over the same language at issue here, cause or contributing to bacteria levels and other pollutants in the Los Angeles River, not what was coming out of the end of pipe, but what was measured in the river. And the Ninth Circuit said, well, that's a violation of permit. Went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court overturned, saying you can't, you know, flows within the river, there's no point source discharge, so there's no liability here. It went back to the Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit doubled down on this language and said, it's in your permit, it's like a contract, it's enforceable. And so then now LA County's been stuck with that and is spending like billions of dollars to make sure that the bacteria levels in these highly channelized portions of the Los Angeles River are safe for fishing and swimming. It's fenced. You're not allowed in there. If there's enough water in there for you to swim in, it's a torrent and you're probably going to, you know, washed away. All of these things are just absurd, but that's been the outcome. I would note that was driven by NRDC filing lawsuits, but the state of California signed a common defense or common prosecution agreement, I guess you call it, with NRDC and joined their side and pursued prosecution in those cases. So I think it's driven by the environmental community. I think it's driven by some of the abuses under the citizen attorney general statutes. But, you know, certain states just let it happen and join in the fun, I guess, you know.
It is interesting. You know, states are big participants in environmental cases before the court. I think California filed a brief on behalf of EPA. And then I guess there's a second brief supporting the EPA's position filed by, I think it's a dozen states or so, states that most of which are states we would typically characterize as blue states. There is not a corresponding red state brief on the other side, which is interesting. Robin, so you know, as I noted, the state of California, a dozen states, environmental organizations are supporting the EPA here. What are, you know, Andre suggested that from the local government perspective, sometimes you get these citizen suits that are, you know, not reasonable efforts to maintain water quality. Presumably, environmental organizations and states believe that if EPA were to lose here, there is a threat to water quality. Could you kind of unpack for us what the concern is on the other side, what the implications of this case would be, presumably beyond the specifics of San Francisco's particular facilities?
Yeah, so, I mean, The burden is kind of who has to do what work. And I won't deny there have been some overzealous lawsuits on occasion. But the other half of it, and the ocean's a particularly good illustration of this, is that water bodies aren't static. And if you know Clean Water Act litigation, there's already been lawsuits about, daily, total maximum daily load, involving nutrients, which are, seasonal. I mean, you've got more nutrients in the water naturally at some times of the year than others. And so, what the Act requires in a total maximum daily load doesn't actually match up with what you need to be doing with nutrients over the course of a year. And the same is true with most water bodies. But like I said, this is particularly dramatic in the ocean. When you set water quality standards for the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Ocean is always changing, even close to shore. And so, it's changing on a daily basis. You've got diurnal cycles where at night critters are coming up from the bottom of the ocean that aren't there during the day. The plankton concentrations change, the pH changes day to night. You got tides coming in and out that change things up. You've got longer term cycles, like the El Nino La Nina oscillation. So the water is going to be warmer in the Pacific during an El Nino year, colder during a La Nina from what's normal. You've got upwellings during certain seasons of the year. That's why the Pacific Coast got great fishing, great commercial fishing, is because of these upwelling of nutrients coming up from the bottom of the ocean. Well, nutrients are pollutant too. So if all of a sudden you've got a natural influx of lots and lots of nutrients, which you actually want because it helps the plankton grow and therefore feed the fish and therefore help the fishery, it's going to change what's going to be reasonable in the discharge potentially. So pH changes, all of these parameters change. So, you know, part of California's point is literally, unless you want 1,000 pages of permit specifying what you can do under all the relevant conditions of the ocean. And by the way, I suspect it would still be the permittee's job to go out and check what the actual conditions of the ocean would be. You know, unless you want 1,000 pages of permit restrictions, depending on what's actually going on with the ocean at that particular moment, we have to have some of these narrative criteria. Some of the examples from California's water quality standards to the Pacific Ocean are: natural light shall not be significantly reduced at any point outside the initial dilution zone as a result of the discharge of waste. The dissolved oxygen concentration, which also fluctuates depending on what time of day and how many nutrients are in the water, shall not be depressed more than 10% from that which occurs naturally. The pH shall not be changed at any time by more than 0.2 units from what occurs naturally. Nutrient materials in the waste shall not cause objectionable aquatic growth or degrade the indigenous biota. So, they're basically saying don't muck with whatever is natural at this particular moment to an excessive degree. If you really want us to spell that out for you, you're not going to be happy with the result. And that's one of the practical points that both the state of California and several of the other amici make is, you really want a permit where we get this specific? You've got a lot of discretion to figure out how to comply with water quality standards as it stands. If you want us to be this specific, we're going to err on the side of caution. You're going to lose a lot of discretion on how to run your operations, and you're going to have a lot more stringent requirements imposed on you than is generally the case now. So like I said, it's kind of a practical thing. The California also points out that San Francisco's had permits for a while, since at least 1979, it's had the CSO exemptions. It's been through this before. It knows, you know, generally what's going to get it in trouble and what's not. And it's making a mountain out of a molehill, basically, is what California comes off as saying. Now, some of the other environmental and community organizations add some other glosses to it. They emphasize that the NPDES permit drafting process is actually iterative. It's not just California and the EPA dictating to San Francisco, this is your permit. San Francisco can and has asked for adjustments here and there when it knows conditions have changed or it's got new information. And so it is a participant in this permit process. And they also make the argument, and Andre's made the counter argument already, that enforcement actions based on violations of these narrative or generic criteria are usually based on pretty obvious violations of the water quality standards. Like, we had to shut the beaches and the shellfish industry down because of all of the E. coli and other bacteria running out from your combined sewer overflow or what have you. There's a lot of practical arguments on the other side as well. the bottom line under the statute is Congress, yes, did go to an end of the pipe model, but it also said we're going to make sure that whatever comes out of that pipe is going to meet the state water quality standards. By definition, you usually only worry about the state water quality standards when the industry-wide technology-based effluent limitations aren't doing the job. So we're already in the realm of we're going to do something more than what the ordinary technology would do. And reconciling those two realities is sort of where this case lands, is how do we make that all work simultaneously in a way that doesn't overburden any of the entities that are involved in the process.
All right. Thank you for that. So Andre, what do you think? 1,000-page permits? I mean, so Robin makes the point that we, one benefit of at least some of these standards is they're relatively simple. They're short. They may not be much longer than, say, the California definition of what constitutes a public nuisance. Would it be worth it to have, permits that are even longer and more detailed? Is that a good trade? If that's the trade-off, and maybe you don't think it is, but would that be a good, from the standpoint of those that have to comply with these standards, is the certainty that would provide a good trade-off?
Right. I that's a great question and a fair point. I don't think that's the trade-off. I think that narrative effluent limitations, narrative conditions in a permit are things that actually public agencies, cities, the folks that was work, representing in the amicus brief, they want to be able to continue to do that. You can't ratchet down every single thing. Sometimes numbers are worse, right? And so they want the flexibility, but they want it end of pipe. They don't want the open-ended liability of backing in the condition of the water quality standard as a compliance measure, or a condition of the receiving water, excuse me, as a compliance measure for their operations. So it, whatever condition you do there, the liability needs to end at the point of discharge, not in the stream. And that's where the 72 amendments come in. And that was the intention of it. And these prohibitions are turning that around.
And I guess one aspect of that history that I guess gets talked about less than this shift from focusing on water bodies to focusing on end of pipe emissions is that was also understood to give industry greater certainty. And if one goes back and looks at the legislative history of the Clean Water Act, it's not remarked upon as much, but prior to the 72 amendments, the use of litigation by either private groups or by the federal government was seen as a much harder to predict set of standards to comply with, right? The industry was worried about, are we the next ones that are going to be targeted by these lawsuits? We would much rather a permit regime where we have a permit shield that as long as we comply, we're safe. And so it is interesting that this case does bring back some of that history. Robin, you mentioned before that historically, in cases on the merits, the Supreme Court has been fairly solicitous of states in Clean Water Act cases. And that might even explain what to some would seem to be an on-again, off-again relationship with the Clean Water Act, right? A somewhat expansive interpretation or a less restrictive than many feared interpretation of the Clean Water Act in the Maui case from a couple of years ago, but then a very a narrower version or approach to defining waters of the United States in the Sackett case. And certainly the relationship to the states might be part of that equation. A couple of years ago, we had that Section 401 case on the shadow docket where the court, I guess, 5-4 upheld the Trump administration rule that was going to limit the ability of states to use 401, according to the Trump administration, to block energy projects and the like. Should we, for folks following this case, should we read much into that shadow docket order from 2 years ago, or is that just kind of noise in the background?
I consider it noise in the background, and I know folks can disagree with me. There's a lot with 401 that needs to be litigated out, time limits on state response probably being the most important thereof. And there was a lot going on with the Trump rules on that. But when it comes to the core issue of, I'll phrase this differently. Worrying about states actually following the letter of the law, which is a lot of the timing stuff, is a different concern than putting substantive limits on what states can do with their water quality standards. And when it comes to upholding the states having minimum stream flow, shall we say, in PUD number one in their water quality standards and being able to uphold that through a Section 401 certification. My split is the SD Warren versus Rapanos, which were decided within weeks of each other. And SD Warren, the water quality standard 40190, state of Maine can do whatever it wants pretty much once it got that hook. And then Rapanos, of course, setting off the whole waters of the United States debacle. I think when confronted with that core authority of states to say what they want their waters to be, what the water quality standards need to be to meet that, I don't think the court's gonna back off from supporting states in that.
I mean, it might be
both as a matter of straight up statutory interpretation and supporting states' rights.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, as I noted before, that insofar as states are participating in this case, they're only on one side of the V. One question we're getting in from an audience member, and just a reminder to audience members, if you have questions, you can put them in the Q&A box, and we can I can raise them with our participants today. One question that's raised is whether or not this is the sort of case where either of you think the major questions doctrine is going to make an appearance. That's certainly it's arisen in other environmental cases. It's something that lower courts, at least some lower courts, are really quick to grab onto at every opportunity, calling something a major question. Is that something we should expect to see here, or is this going to be a more kind of routine, let's dig into the text, dig into the structure, dig into the history, and just answer it that way? And whichever one of you wants to jump on that.
I would say it should be routine. I mean, if there's anything that's not a major question in the Clean Water Act, it's imposing effluent limitations and NPDES permits. I mean, that's the core of the act. So if major questions means the agency is doing something weird that it's never done before, that's stretching its core authority, NPDES permits and putting terms in those NPDES permits is about as core to both the EPA and the delegated states authority as you can get. So I would say it's going to be more, should be more of just a standard bread and butter statutory interpretation, maybe getting into the due process and notice aspects as well. But I don't think they need to go beyond that.
Andre, do you have thoughts on that?
I do agree with that in many ways. Where you've seen major questions come up in the Clean Water Act cases, often involving definition of waters of the United States, often involving the limits of congressional authority, how to interpret the act in terms of constitutional limitations, without just keeping with the framework of the act, so you have to go there, right? That's kind of where we've seen it in the past. And as you just mentioned, like this is an effluent limit question, you know, so it's not quite there. But I think there is this other facet to it that kind of was avoided in some of the briefing, and it came up in the Ninth Circuit, is like, what is the authority of EPA to impose these kinds of conditions without any kind of regulations or anything on point? Like that is actually a big piece of the Ninth Circuit decision, is they get Chevron deference and then they go further and they say, sure, there's all these regulations on how you're supposed to adopt effluent limitations, but those don't tell us that we can't do this. They just say we're supposed to do this. And so, you know, you have direction on how to do one thing administratively and then silence, and EPA chose, well, silence is authority. Like that kind of becomes a more of a bigger administrative law question. I think San Francisco is really trying to avoid those kind of issues. They want to keep it narrow. They want to keep it on the statute. And I think that Professor Kinskrag mentioned before, is like, you know, they, so much so that the EPA responded saying you waived all arguments that aren't in your brief, you know? So, I think the San Francisco is trying to avoid that, but those questions are there and they do come out of the Ninth Circuit case. And so, you know, I think it's worth, if you haven't read the Ninth Circuit case, you know, those of us who are listening, it's worth taking a read and asking those questions yourself.
Yeah, and there's a kind of a good kind of practice reminder for folks that deal in a lot of these technical areas, is that what makes the Supreme Court interested in the case and what the litigants are focused on might not always be the same things. I mean, certainly for myself, I think some of the notice and due process concerns, which you see the justices, especially some of them in concurrences, really raising consistently in various administrative law cases, you know, do the folks that have to comply know what's expected of them? And even though this is a city as opposed to some small landowner or some small business, you could certainly imagine that for some of the justices, that makes this a really interesting case, as well as, is the EPA trying to exercise authority in a way that Congress didn't clearly authorize? That's the sort of question that the justices seem to be interested in. You know, the technical workings of the Clean Water Act, that might not interest them as much. And insofar as that's what the litigants want the decision to be based on, that does create an interesting tension, which is worth watching. We have a related question here about how, you know, environmental law is filled with these phrases that kind of sound like narrative standards. Do either of you have the concern or think it's possible that what the court does here could have reverberations in other aspects of environmental law, whether it's the Clean Water Act or perhaps even other statutes like the Clean Air Act? And I think one thing that gives a point to that question is, I think it's fair to say that most of the justices are not environmental law specialists. And there is sometimes a concern that when they focus on something in an environmental case, they're not aware of how certain statutory provisions or certain mechanisms are replicated in other statutes in ways that could be impacted if they accidentally sweep too broadly. And I'm wondering if either of you think that's a potential concern or something to watch for here.
Well, I always get concerned that the Supreme Court will make broad sweeping statements about environmental law that weren't fully fleshed out in the context and could reverberate. I think the problem with this case, and I've kind of alluded to it before, is line drawing. Because I don't think any of us would say you can't have narrative standards or, you know, even your classic torts wiggle duties like use due diligence or whatnot. We've got to have some things that are responsive to context in environmental law. And so what's due diligence in one context or what satisfies your duty in one context is going to be different than what satisfies it in another. But that, there's nothing new in environmental law about that. I mean, that's torts 101. That's the common law is full of, you know, what is a reasonable person, to pick the biggest one. So I think any pronouncements of you can't have any non-spelled out duties is going to be one of those times when the Supreme Court makes a general statement and the very next case they have to retract from it because the law itself is unworkable with that kind of a standard. But as I've indicated before, it's like, you know, there are general standards and there are general standards, and you know, we live with nuisance, even though it's very hard to know in advance on a close case whether you're a public nuisance or not. We live with it. But does that mean, as Andres pointed out, that a permit discharger or somebody discharging under a permit should live in fear that this extra little drop of whatever is suddenly going to render them a public nuisance under California law? That I think would be pushing that spectrum too far. So Yeah, I do get concerned that they might make a broader statement than they need to make.
Andre?
I mean, I think there's gradations, right? And it depends on where the court goes. I mean, I think that the two things that actually just came up in our last conversation just a second ago, one, the arbitrary nature of these particular prohibitions. And if we got a decision that really focused on that, it might bleed over into many other, you know, compliance regimes dealing with environmental law in particular, but probably even others. Then also the sort of the amount of deference EPA is due under interpreting its own regulations and or under Loper Bright even for implementing this program. That latter one, you know, like I said, San Francisco has tried to avoid that, and EPA certainly wasn't going to, you know, raise it themselves. So it's kind of not before them anymore. You know, I think the ideal outcome for San Francisco would be a very narrow, unanimous decision. Hey, wouldn't it be great for everybody, right? Any litigant before the court, you know, that really just focuses on the textual language of the statute. That's not going to bleed anywhere. And I mean, as Professor Allard mentioned at the very beginning, San Francisco has an interest in not harming the compliance regime of any of our environmental statutes. That is one of their core focuses. But internal tension about, you know, compliance and the liability that this language brings put them in this position, right? So they're walking a tightrope of wanting to protect the environmental, you know, structure of our federal acts and state acts for that matter, but also trying to protect their own, you know, interests. And I think that their desired outcome, and, you know, I'm just guessing here, but based on, you know, what we've seen, it would be a very narrow decision that doesn't implicate other regimes.
We have a question in the chat. Oh, go ahead, Robin.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'll throw it in if we have time at the end.
There's a question in the chat that kind of, well, we've spoken a lot about the specific context here being ocean, or emissions into the ocean, and how that raises particular concerns. There's a question in the chat raising whether or not this is also a concern kind of inland. It in particular mentions the amount of water flowing from the Colorado and the upper basin states to California, and whether that by dilution causes distortions or effects on whether or not facilities are in and out of compliance. And that makes me think more broadly, you know, to what extent is this sort of concern that changing ecological conditions, changing levels of rainfall and the like, affect the extent to which regulated entities know whether or not they're in compliance, even beyond the ocean context?
I mean, that makes the case, right? That's the argument that our, you know, cities and municipalities have been, you know, trying to make for a long time. In natural conditions, farmers will use all kinds of fertilizer on their fields upstream, or they'll have CAFOs that'll have all kinds of nutrients, phosphorus, whatever, entering the river. And then downstream, there's a municipal treatment plant that puts some phosphorus and some nitrogen. And it's the downstream municipality that gets tagged under this compliance regime with having to pay for all this cleanup, because the Clean Water Act, as we know, is not very good at reaching these non-point sources. I mean, they regulate CAFOs, but farmers, other kinds of irrigated agriculture, it's not very good at reaching. So yeah, it imposes, you know, that was the Colorado River provides a good example. The Mississippi and Missouri River systems provide better examples because there's more fertilizer and more nutrients going into those systems that are from, you know, agriculture and return flows and stuff like that. So, you know, certainly that's a good example. And in my view, makes the case for why municipalities are concerned about this.
And is it the case that in some of these systems that things like changes in annual rainfall or the timing of snowmelt and things like that?
Certainly. You'd have, Colorado is a great example on that too. You get a really dry summer, you get a lot of evaporation, TDS goes up, and maybe the TDS limits from you know, the Clean Water Act permit could be, you know, triggered at that time of year versus the winter when there's lots of rain coming in. And so, yes, seasonal changes can certainly make a difference. And again, natural conditions that change over time, imagine having to comply with that based on, you know, you have to tailor your discharges to the season. I guess it's not totally unreasonable, but you would at least want certainty if you're going to do that.
And I know, Robin, you've written about how our ability to predict some of these changes has actually declined over time, that we don't have stationarity in water systems the way we used to. So even trying to make seasonal predictions at least could be more challenging in at least some parts of the country.
Right. And, you know, this is another area. Andre mentioned farms. The Clean Water Act leaves farms largely off the hook. We have no great way of connecting water allocation law, particularly in the West, to water quality law. California actually is one of the exception states in that regard. They do think about them simultaneously, but most states don't. And so we have changing conditions. And one response to that, and San Francisco would be capable of doing it, whether they want to do it or not is a different thing, is it's like if you want certainty, one way to get certainty is to say, okay, you go to tertiary plus treatment, ultraviolet it, it's distilled water when it comes out of your pipe, all right? That solves everybody's problem, except it's kind of expensive to do. Now, there are other reasons on the water issue that San Francisco might actually want to do that, but they're going to be reusing the water and not sending it to the Pacific Ocean. So, you know, like I said, there are other ways of looking at the certainty issue, too. And particularly for combined sewer overflow problems, you know, EPA can and has forced cities to separate their sewer and their overflow systems. And you can up the treatment from secondary treatment, which is the standard under the Clean Water Act. So again, yes, I acknowledge the problem, but whether what the solution is to that doesn't necessarily help San Francisco so much unless San Francisco is willing to go the full route on treatment. So.
Well, we have time for one last question as we're at the bottom of the hour. There is a question in the chat about, you know, is this the sort of issue that we think could provoke Congress to fix this? You know, if the court does something unusual or extreme, is this the sort of issue that could finally prompt Congress to revisit the Clean Water Act after however many decades? Or are we going to still muddle along through the administrative process?
We're muddling.
This is not. Yeah, we're muddling. If Congress wasn't willing to step in on waters of the United States, which had at least a couple of easy fixes to it, we're muddling on this one.
Fair enough. I don't know if either of you had any closing thoughts before we head out.
Just thanks for having me.
Like I said, oral argument will be interesting, and I think we'll learn a lot about where the court chooses to focus its questions and where the justices are going on some of these issues. So,
and oral argument is on October 16th. But thank you both for joining us today, and I will turn it back over to Edith.
Yes, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor Craig and Andre for speaking and to Professor Adler for moderating. We really are grateful for your time and expertise today. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your active participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.